Hello and welcome to NC State's Audio Abstract. I'm your host, Tracy Peake. Honeybees are amazing insects, from their contribution to agriculture to their delicious honey. But how do they do what they do? We're speaking today with David Tarpey, professor of applied ecology and all-around bee expert, on what bees know. Welcome, David.
Great. Thanks, Tracy.
Let's get started by just talking about bees in general. How many species of honeybee are there?
Worldwide, there are 9 species of honeybees, but only one of them is here in America. And in fact, even though they're our state insect, they're not native to the Americas. They were actually imported by the first European settlers. So we have the indigenous species that's in Europe and in all of Africa, all of the other species of honeybees are in Southeast Asia.
Does anyone have an idea of how many honeybees we have in the U.S.?
We have good guesses and estimates, but it's a hard number to really pin down. Our best guess right now, based on USDA surveys, is that we have 2.9 million managed honeybee colonies in the U.S., which is actually a slight uptick in the last decade or so when colony collapse disorder was making a lot of headlines. We only had about 2.4 million beehives there. So the colony collapse issue and the problems that honeybees and beekeepers have been having is not the total population of managed beehives. It's their ability to keep them alive and healthy, right? So we're losing something like 40% of honeybee colonies every single year. So beekeepers have 40% of their colonies dying every year, but then they grow them back, right? So because they're managed, they're able to do that. So we have this oscillating population, this unsustainable, right, population of bees, of honeybees, that makes it more difficult to address our pollination needs.
So I was going to ask you, you know, if there was a particular species of bee that was popular, but since there's only one species of bee, of honeybee, in the U.S., that is a silly question. What
but
is
there
the species?
Are many different stocks or breeds, okay, right? There are different types of the same species, right? So there are many different subspecies in Europe and in Africa. The notorious one that we've all heard about are Apis mellifera scutellata, or the killer honeybee, the Africanized bees. We don't have those in North Carolina. Those are kind of tropically adapted, so they tend to be more defensive oriented, hence the name. But there's lots of other different types of Apis mellifera ligustica that we have here in North Carolina and in the U.S. So there's something like 20 or so, a couple dozen subspecies, half of which I would say that we have here in the U.S. But in essence, everything, because they're the same species, they're subspecies, they can interbreed. So we just have kind of good old American mutts is what we have with our honeybees.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I was like, you know, if you had a subspecies in your hives that you were managing, could you get a queen from another subspecies if you had to replace one?
You can. Okay. So, and in fact, there is a niche industry within apiculture where there are queen producers and bee breeders that are selecting for stock where there's some colonies make more honey, some colonies are better at overwintering, some colonies are more disease resistant, right? So those different breeds, those different stocks have different traits to them, just like, you know, in other kind of systems.
It's like the AKC of bees, right? Okay. Do you want the St. Bernard bee or do you want the Chihuahua bee?
Correct. Maybe not quite as diverse or different as we see in canines, but it's the same kind of aspect that colonies have different traits. And so selecting for those traits or against unfavorable traits is what bee breeders do.
Okay. On a related note, when you mentioned, you know, the Africanized bees, I remember being alive as a child and we were all terrified that the killer bees were going to take over the entire country. Mm-hmm. Where did they just kind of stop? Did they get to a certain place and they're like, we can't really go any further than this? Or
so
what happened?
That's a great question. They were in the 70s and 80s. There were just so many killer bee films, bad bee films that were made about this looming threat. And they did arrive in southern Texas in 1990, and they did kind of fill the ecological kind of niche in the southern tier of the U.S., but they've kind of petered out because, again, they're tropically adapted. So colder winters or just colder temperatures in general are not as they're not as amenable to that. So they haven't really kind of spread further northward like was predicted back in the 70s and 80s. So, you know, pretty much they're kind of a non-issue now because they always were, right? They were just sensationalized more than they were an actual threat to people and to beekeepers. They're just not as amenable to beekeeping because they are more defensive and they're not as they can't be used in commercial apiculture where they move from one orchard to another orchard because that kind of movement by a beekeeper, they'll just get up and leave. So so that was always really the main threat, but beekeepers in the U.S. have been able to handle it for, you know, the last several decades, and it's pretty much a moot point.
Do they interbreed with, like, our tame colonies that we have?
They do. Okay. Right? Because they're also a subspecies. So that's always been part of the problem of how genetically are they going to be integrated into the U.S. population. But again, beekeepers are on the front lines. So if they see any of these kind of tropical or Africanized traits, they just swap out the queen of that colony, replace the genetics, and they're able to stay on top of it.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Young me is relieved that we are not under constant threat of killer bees. Do bees recognize their beekeepers? Can bees recognize faces?
So the short answer to that is yes. Bees can recognize the faces and differentiate faces of humans, so they can recognize their beekeepers over somebody else. There was this really interesting and splashy study that was done coming out of Cambridge, I think, in 2004 or 2005, around that time, that demonstrated that, where they were able to reward bees and have them learn human faces and discriminate among human faces. Bees are really, really good at learning. So kind of like training Pavlov's dogs, right, where they would salivate just by the ring of the bell, bees can stick out their tongues expecting a little bit of, you know, honey reward if they get a particular stimulus. So they can see how well they learn and if they can learn different faces, and the answer is they can. The real question is if they do, right, in kind of normal practice. Probably not. There's no real need for them to distinguish one big mammal from another big mammal, right? But the fact is that they can. And, you know, it's very interesting how well they can learn and discriminate different things in their environment.
Has there been any anecdotal, like, stories that you hear from beekeepers in conversation who talk about how their bees know they're coming or their bees recognize them or interact with them when they walk toward the hive?
Absolutely. This happens all the time. If you go out and visit your colony the same time day after day, they will be waiting for you. They will anticipate your arrival, right? But that's really based on their ability to learn things like, oh, this flowering plant only opens up in the late afternoon. And so, you know, they're able to integrate these kind of collective decisions, you know, through their circadian rhythms to be able to anticipate rewards that are important to them, such as pollen and nectar that's in their environment, the food that they eat, or threats such as bears or, you know, humans coming and robbing their honey. So they can actually distinguish and learn those things over time.
And why don't they get more upset when you harvest their honey if you're a beekeeper? Or do they get upset and that's why they smoke, they put the smoke on them?
Well, two things. One is that honeybees are actually not nearly as defensive as what we have in our heads, in our zeitgeist, okay? Honeybees are actually quite passive. Yes, they don't like their homes being robbed of their resources. So, but again, then the second thing, as you just said, beekeepers for millennia have been using smoke to pacify the bees because they have very bad eyesight, even though they can see human faces. Their eyesight is not nearly as good as their sense of smell, which is the primary means by which they communicate. An alarm pheromone is something that increases their defensiveness. If another nestmate recognizes that they're being robbed of their honey, they will send out the alarm pheromone and everybody else will get a little more defensive. Smoke masks that alarm pheromone, and so it greatly pacifies them. And so beekeepers can go in and work the hives safely without them getting overly defensive.
Well, that leads me perfectly into my next question, which is what do bees see? You said their eyesight is not as good as their sense of smell. So is that how they're differentiating between objects in the world? Like, here's a flower, here's a car, here's a tree.
Yes, but they put together this very blurry mosaic of different images. They can't focus like we do with our eyes and really be able to discern specific things. But why are flowers very colorful? Because it makes them stand out from a background of green. Right. So they can see these blurry images of the flowers, but they're very attracted to color. Right. So that's how they're able to find flowers in the environment. But more importantly is their sense of smell, which is, again, twice as good as that of dogs. They are very, very discriminating when it comes to smell. So between those two things, they're able to, you know, really make sense of their universe. And you got to remember, too, is that the first half of an adult worker's life is spent in the dark in the hive doing chores on behalf of the colony. It's only the last 3 weeks of her life or so that she's out foraging in the environment anyway. So their eyesight is important, but it pales in comparison to understanding their universe than their sense of smell.
Is that why beekeepers wear white?
Correct. They tend to wear light clothing or white overalls, not just as a means of protection from stings, the occasional sting, but more because it provides less of a contrast with the background. And the bees, because they can't focus very well, they can see moving objects and they can see contrast much more easily. So they can see something if it sticks out from the background. So wearing light-colored clothing helps to minimize their defensive response to that. And then there's also a phrase, no jerks in the bee yard, which is not just only you can only keep bees if you're nice, but also you don't want fast, rapid movements. You want to move very slowly and methodically because then it doesn't alarm the bees.
Oh, I'm learning a lot about beekeeping and I like it. On a kind of similar note, you had mentioned that in the hive, the worker bee is only going to go out and forage for pollen for the last 3 weeks of their lives. How long does a bee live?
A typical worker bee, that is the majority of that 50,000 within the colony, lives about 6 weeks in the summer.
Okay.
So the first 3 weeks, they're doing chores inside like nursing the young, building the comb, ripening the honey, those kind of things. And then the last three, they're out foraging for their two food sources, nectar and pollen. So nectar is sugar water in flowers that the bees collect, bring back, and that's what they make their honey from. And then pollen, also from flowers, is their protein source. So they bring that back to the hive, and then they feed that to the young, the developing young, as the protein source. So all of honeybees are vegans, right? only plant-sourced foods.
Right.
And they go out and they can forage up to 4 miles away from the hive, collect the resources that they're looking for, bring them back, and they're providing that to the rest of the hive for them to have something to eat.
I've always wondered exactly how, you know, getting the pollen from place to place translates into honey. And it's not. The pollen is just what they're eating. And the nectar is the honey, or is it?
Right. Well, they're eating both. But pollen is their protein source that they're feeding only the young.
Okay.
The nectar is their carbohydrate source that they themselves are eating for fuel. But then also feeding to the young, but then also any excess they're storing in the combs, ripening it into honey so that it doesn't spoil, so that they have something to eat during the winter. Honeybee colonies make it through the winter as a colony, just huddling inside the hive, staying warm and eating the honey that they collected all summer.
Okay. How much does it take and how long does it take to fill like an average size honeycomb, like a beehive frame sized honeycomb?
Yeah. So the average honey yield of a colony in North Carolina is about 50 pounds of honey per year. And that's surplus, you know, honey. But it only takes, a single worker's lifetime of flying from the hive and coming back many times a day for 3 weeks of her foraging life, she only makes the equivalent about of a 16th of a teaspoon. So it takes a tremendous amount of effort in order to make pounds and pounds of honey. But again, collectively, when you have 50,000 bees working all summer long, it adds up, and that's how they're able to make their honey so that they can survive the winter.
How do they ripen? You referred to ripening the honey. What exactly happens?
Yeah, so the nectar is, again, it's a sugary bribe to literally lure the bees to the flowers so that the plant can be cross-pollinated, right? So it's a reward for them to just visit, but it's very dilute. It's, you know, on average, it's about 20 to 40% sugar. Honey is like 85% sugar. So by ripening it, what the bees in the hive have to do is evaporate off that excess moisture. And they also actually kind of chemically convert the sugars from the nectar to the main sugars that are in honey. And then once it is dried enough and kind of ripened, they seal the cell over with wax. And as long as it's airtight, it will never spoil. It is so devoid of moisture, and it's so sugary sweet, and it has a low pH. All of those things are against microbial growth, so it won't spoil.
I had read an article just the other week where they were pulling out jars of honey from like Egypt or something, yep. And they were still, because they were sealed, perfectly fine.
It was not spoiled.
Not perfectly fine.
I would probably say it would taste like garbage, but yeah. You know, it does.
Okay, excellent. And then to kind of come back to, you know, we talked a little bit about colony collapse at the beginning. What we heard so much about it for so many years, is that, like, where are we with that right now? What's going on?
Yeah, so colony collapse disorder really made a lot of headlines, in large part because it was mysterious. And again, beekeepers have been dealing with colony losses for a very long time. There's a lot of threats from pests and disease. There's a lot of threats from pesticides in the environment. There's a lot of threats from deforestation and the loss of habitat. So there's not as much nectar and pollen out there for them to gather, right? So all of those things have been very problematic. But there came this tipping point in kind of 2006, 2007, where it made a lot of headlines of these mysterious reasons why colonies were dying, not the typical reasons why colonies were dying. And we've never really kind of been able to figure that out, because it's such a complex, you know, issue of all these different moving parts that we just think collectively is just an overaccumulation of stressors is in essence what that is. And we don't really see that syndrome happening nearly as much as it was 10, 15 years ago. But the threats are and the stressors are still there, right? So again, we're still losing 40% of our colonies every single year, but that doesn't mean that the total population is in steady decline. It declines and then bounces back because the beekeepers are growing them back. But a lot of us are worried, and my question is, well, what happens if the beekeepers can't, right? Like, you know, it's an unsustainable model of a kind of this turnover rate. And so what we really need to do is come up with solutions to alleviate these stressors so that the colonies don't die off as much. And so it's economically better for the beekeepers and it's more stable and sustainable for greater agriculture.
So it's a amalgamation of stressors, and then the colony will eventually just reach a tipping point.
Yeah.
Because for a while they were talking about mites or disease, but it could be mites and disease have been around for a while, but that combined with less flowers to find and
correct
predators and this, that, and the other thing.
Correct. Just evolving land. Viruses, new, you know, families or formulas of pesticides that are out there, right?
Right.
Like all of these things are, it's such a complex Gordian knot that it's been really, really hard to untangle. But honeybees and really all pollinators are so important that we need to keep our eyes on them because they're kind of the canaries in the coal mine to our how we're treating our environment and just, you know, making sure that we don't go too far.
Okay. One random question about bee stings. Do honeybees die when they sting you?
Honeybees do.
100%.
That's
wasps
correct.
Wasps are terrible and
wasps
they will not
are
die.
Not bees.
Yeah. Right.
Yellow jackets are wasps.
Okay.
Most people, when they get stung by a quote-unquote bee, it's really a yellow jacket. And they give honeybees a bad name. That's why everybody thinks that they're so defensive. Because yellow jackets and other wasps are, and they don't die when they sting. So they'll just kind of keep coming after you. And again, they give honeybees a bad name. Honeybees, though, are unique, even among other bees, where their stingers are barbed, like a fish hook. So as it kind of goes into our elastic skin, it gets left behind as they pulled away. And the stinger remains with the poison sac that actually still has muscles that are kind of pumping the venom into us. It's a very effective deterrent, right? If there's a great way to drive away a bear or other predator from the colony, that's a very effective thing. So the sacrifice of the one benefits the many. But not all bees do that, and certainly wasps don't.
Okay. I just always felt bad for the honeybees.
Yep.
All right. Well, that leads me to my final question, which is a question I ask everybody on the podcast, which is, what is the coolest thing you've learned about bees? Your favorite bee fact?
Oh, my goodness. You can't possibly think that I can narrow that down to one.
You can have a few.
I think one of the real sensational things that I think a lot of people have heard about when it comes to honeybees is the famous dance language, where they have a means of communicating to others. If they find a patch of flowers in the environment, they can come back and tell their sisters exactly where those flowers are by doing these kind of dances on the vertical comb in the dark. And it's the only other abstract form of language in the animal kingdom, except for human languages, because it translates the direction of where the food is with respect to where the sun is. So they're using gravity as a proxy of where the sun is. And so they're communicating in the abstract. And that's just fascinating. And it's just really well known. And the scientists who did a lot of work on that got the Nobel Prize for it because it really is sensational. But that's not my favorite fact. That's not my favorite thing. The thing that continues to really fascinate me when it comes to bee biology is that in biology, we learn that everything is a combination of kind of genetics in the environment, nature and nurture, right? That any trait that we have, eye color, you know, how, you know, strong we are, you know, all these different traits are a function not just of our genetics, but what we do in our lives in order for those things to come together. Well, in honeybees, they're kind of the one example, they're the best example that I know, where making the bees is either nature or nurture. So there are three types of bees in the colonies, the workers that we've been talking about. The drones, which are the males, they don't do any work. Their only purpose is for reproduction. And then the queen, a single queen within the colony, and she's the mother of all the workers and drones within it. Now, in order to make a male drone, the queen just simply doesn't fertilize the egg. So the males don't have any fathers. So the distinction between males and females is entirely genetic, has nothing to do with their environment or what they're fed. Anything else is entirely genetic. But once you have a female larva, it can become either a worker or a queen. There's no genetic distinction between those, and it's entirely what they're fed as a larva. If they're fed kind of a bread and water diet, kind of a thinned down kind of honey and pollen, they become a stunted, sterile worker bee. But if they're fed this nutritious food that you've probably heard of, royal jelly, then it develops into a queen. So it's entirely nurture to make a queen versus a worker. It has nothing to do with genetics, but to make a drone, it's entirely genetics and has nothing to do with nurture.
That's really amazing. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the little drones. We always forget the drones.
Yeah, a lot of people use drones and, kind of workers interchangeably. That's really an insult to the workers, I think. The drones, they don't do any work. Their only, job is to fly from the hive and look for love among queens from other hives. But they then get kind of kicked out of the colony going into winter and they don't survive.
Well, there's your payback. Well, thank you so much for being here today. We could talk about bees probably all day, but that would be a very, very long podcast that people might not want to listen to. But I do appreciate this has been fascinating. Thank you for
being
here.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity.
We have been speaking today with David Tarpey, Professor of Applied Ecology here at NC State. This has been Audio Abstract. I'm your host, Tracy Peake. Thank you so much for listening.